probably go to Stanford, where his parents had gone, and his grandfather, too. The one school on the West Coast that matched the Ivy League for exclusivity. Stellar grades weren't enough. Perfect SAT scores didn't guarantee admittance either. No way would she get a scholarship from Stanford. David tightened his hold on her hand. He smiled down at her. "Believe," that smile said. She wanted to. "This is my son, David Ryerson Haynes," Mrs. Haynes was saying now. "Of the Ryerson Haynes Paper Company?" She hadn't added that, of course. It would have been tacky and wholly unnecessary. "And this is Lauren Ribido," David said, squeezing Lauren's hand. "She'd be a real asset to Stanford's student body." The recruiter smiled at David. "So, David," he said, "you're interested in following in your father's footsteps. Good for you. At Stanford, we'd pride ourselves on..." Lauren stood there, holding David's hand so tightly her fingers started to ache. She waited patiently for the recruiter to turn his attention to her. He never did. The bus jerked to a stop at the corner. Lauren grabbed her backpack off the floor and hurried to the front of the bus. "Have a nice night," Luella, the bus driver, said. Lauren waved and headed down Main Street. Here, in the tourist hub of downtown West End, everything was sparkling and beautiful. Years ago, when the timber and commercial fishing industries had hit hard times, the town fathers had decided to play up the Victorian cuteness of the town. Half of downtown's buildings already fit the bill. The other half were hurriedly remodeled. A statewide advertising campaign was started. For a solid year, the city government paid for nothing else, not roads or schools or services. And West End, Victorian getaway on the coast, was born. It worked. Tourists drifted in, drawn by the bed and breakfasts, the sandcastle competitions, the kite flying, and the sport fishing. It became a destination instead of a detour on the road from Seattle to Portland. But the veneer only went so deep. And like all towns, West End had its forgotten places, its corners that remained unseen by visitors and unvisited by locals. That part of town, the place where people lived in apartments without decorations or security, Lauren's part of town. She turned off Main Street and kept walking. With each step, the neighborhood deteriorated. The world became darker, more run down. There were no Victorian-inspired curlicues on the buildings here, no advertisements for quaint bed and breakfasts or seaplane rides. This was where the old-timers lived, men who'd once worked in the timber mills or on the fishing boats, the people who'd missed the tide of change and been washed into the dark, muddy marshlands. Here, the only bright lights were neon signs that advertised booze. Lauren walked briskly, looking straight ahead. She noticed every nuance of change, every shadow that seemed new, every noise and movement, but she wasn't afraid. This street had been her home turf for more than 6 years. Though most of her neighbors were down on their luck, they knew how to take care of one another, and little Lauren Ribido belonged here. Home was a narrow, six-story apartment building that sat dead center on a lot overgrown with blackberry bushes and salal. The stucco exterior was grayed with dirt and debris. Light shone from behind several windows, giving the place its only sign of life. Lauren hiked up the creaking steps, pushed through the front door. The lock had been broken 5 times last year. The property manager, Mrs. Mock, refused to fix it again, and climbed the tired steps to the third floor. As she crept past the manager's door, she held her breath. She was almost to the stairs when she heard the door open. Heard, "Lauren? Is that you?" "Damn it." She turned around, trying to smile. "Hello, Mrs. Mock." Mrs. Mock, call me Dolores, honey, stepped into the shadowy hallway. Light from the open doorway made her look pale, almost sinister, but her toothy smile was bright. As always, she wore a navy blue kerchief over her graying hair in a floral house dress. The wrinkles on her face looked as if they'd been drawn in thick ink. There was a rumpled look to her, as if she'd just been unfolded from an old suitcase. Her shoulders were hunched by a lifetime of disappointment. It was a common stance in this neighborhood.
"I went to the salon today."
"Uh-huh."
"Your mom didn't show for work."
"She's sick."
Mrs. Mock clucked sympathetically. "New boyfriend again."
Lauren couldn't answer.
"Maybe this time it'll be love. Anyhow, you're overdue on the rent. I need it by Friday."
"Okay." Lauren couldn't hold on to her smile. Mrs. Mock gave her the look.
"You don't look warm enough in that coat," she said, frowning. "You tell your mom."
"I will. Bye." She ran for the stairs and went up to the fourth floor. Their door was ajar. Light spilled between the crack, slanted butter-like across the linoleum hallway. Lauren wasn't worried. Her mom rarely remembered to shut the front door, and when she did remember to close it, she never locked it. Lost her keys too often. That was the excuse. Lauren opened the door and went inside. The kitchen was a mess. An open pizza box covered one end of the counter. A stack of beer bottles stood beside it. Open potato chip bags were everywhere. The place smelled of cigarettes and sweat. Mom lay on the sofa, arms and legs akimbo. A rumbling snore came up from the tangle of blankets that covered her face. With a sigh, Lauren went into the kitchen and cleaned everything up, then went to the couch and knelt down.
"Come on, Mom. I'll help you to bed."
"What? Huh?"
Mom sat up, bleary-eyed. Her short, tousled hair, platinum this month, stuck out around her pale face. She reached shakily for the beer bottle on the end table. She took a long drink, then sat it back down. Her aim was off, unsteady. The bottle thunked to the floor, spilling its contents. She looked like a broken doll, with her face cocked to one side. She was porcelain pale. Blue-black mascara smudged around her eyes, looking like bruises. The faintest hint of her once great beauty remained, like a glimmer of gold trim on a dirty china plate peeking through.
"He left me."
"Who did, Mom?"
"Cal. And he swore he loved me."
"Yeah, they always do."
She bent down for the beer bottle, wondering if they had any paper towels to blot up the mess. Probably not. Mom's paychecks were getting thinner lately. Supposedly, it was the sagging economy. Mom swore that fewer women were coming to see her at the salon. Lauren figured that was half of the story. The other half was that the Hair Apparent Beauty Salon was four doors down from the Tides Tavern. Mom reached for her cigarettes and lit one up.
"You're giving me that look again. The fuck me, my mom's a loser look."
Lauren sat down on the coffee table. As much as she tried not to feel the sting of disappointment, it was there. She always seemed to want too much from her mother. When would she learn? These continual letdowns were eating through her. Sometimes she imagined she could even see them as a shadow above her heart. The college fair was today. Mom took another drag, frowning as she exhaled.
"That's on Tuesday."
"This is Tuesday, Mom."
"Oh, shit."
Mom leaned back onto the nubby, avocado-green sofa.
"I'm sorry, honey. I lost track of the days."
She exhaled again, scooted sideways.
"Sit."
Lauren moved fast before Mom changed her mind.
"How did it go?"
She snuggled next to her mother.
"I met a great guy from USC. He thought I should try and get recommendations from alumni."
She sighed.
"I guess who you know helps.
Only if who you know will pay the tab, too. Mom took another drag. Lauren heard the hard edge come into her mother's voice, and she winced. I'll get a scholarship, Mom. You'll see. Mom took a long drag on her cigarette and turned slightly, studying Lauren through the filmy haze. Lauren braced herself. She knew what was coming. She shook her head, wanting to say, Not today, please. I thought I'd get a scholarship, too, you know.
Please don't. Let's talk about something else. I got an A+ on my honors history paper.
Lauren tried to get up. Mom grabbed her wrist, held her in place. My grades were okay, Mom said, unsmiling, her brown eyes growing even darker. I lettered in track and basketball. My test scores were damned respectable, too. And I was beautiful. They said I looked like Heather Locklear.
Lauren sighed. She edged sideways, putting a tiny space between them.
I know. Then I went to the Sadie Hawkins dance with Thad Marlowe.
I know. Big mistake.
A few kisses, a few shots of tequila, and there I was with my dress around my waist. I didn't know then that I was fucked in more ways than just the one. 4 months later, I was a senior in high school shopping for maternity dresses. No scholarship for me, no college, no decent job. If one of your stepfathers hadn't paid for beauty school, I'd probably be living in the streets and eating other people's leftovers. So, Missy, you keep your knees shut. Believe me, Mom, I know how I ruined your life.
Ruined is harsh, Mom said with a tired sigh. I never said ruined.
I wonder if he had other children, Lauren said.
She'd asked this same question every time her father's name was mentioned. She couldn't seem to help herself, though she knew the answer by heart.
How would I know? He ran from me like I had the plague.
I just wish I had relatives, that's all.
Mom exhaled smoke. Believe me, family is overrated. Oh, they're fine till you screw up, but then, wham, they break your heart. Don't you count on people, Lauren.
Lauren had heard all this before. I just wish...
Don't. It'll only hurt you.
Lauren looked at her mother. Yeah, she said tiredly. I know.
Chapter 4. For the next few days, Angie did what she did best. She threw herself into a project. She woke long before dawn and spent all day studying. She called friends and former clients, anyone who'd ever been involved in the restaurant or food service business, and wrote down every word of their advice. Then she read and reread the account books until she understood every dollar that came in and every penny that went out. When she finished that, she went to the library. Hour after hour, she sat at the cheap Formica table with books and articles strewn out in front of her, reading every word. Then she parked herself at the microfiche machine and read the archived material. At 6 o'clock, the librarian, Mrs. Martin, who'd been old when Angie got her first library card, turned off the lights. Angie got the hint. She carried several armfuls of books to her car and drove back to the cottage where she kept reading, long into the night. She fell asleep on the sofa, which was infinitely preferable to being in bed alone. While she was doing her research, her family called like clockwork. She answered each call politely, talked for a few moments, then gently hung up. She would, she said repeatedly, let them know when she was ready to see the restaurant. At each such call, Mama snorted and said crisply, You cannot learn without doing, Angela. To which Angie replied, I can't do without learning, Mama. I'll let you know when I'm ready.
Always you were obsessive, Mama would reply. We do not understand you.
There was more than a little truth in that, Angie knew. She had always been a woman with laser-like focus. When she started something, there was no halfway, no easy beginning. It was this trait that had broken her. Quite simply, once she'd decided, "I want a child," there had been ruin on the horizon. It was the thing she couldn't have, and the search had taken everything. She knew this, had learned it, but still, she was who she was. When she undertook something, she focused on success. And to be honest, which she was with herself only in the quiet darkness of the deepest hour of night, it was better to think about the restaurant than to dwell on the losses and failures that had brought her here. They were with her, of course, those memories and heartaches. Sometimes, as she was reading about management techniques or special promotions, she'd flash on the past. Sophie would have been sleeping through the night by now. Or, Conlon loved that song. It was like stepping barefoot on a sharp bit of broken glass. She pulled the glass out and ran on, but the pain remained. In those moments, she redoubled her efforts at studying, perhaps poured herself a glass of wine. By Wednesday, she was exhausted by her lack of sleep and finished with her research. There was nothing more she could learn from secondary sources. It was time to apply her learning to the restaurant. She got up, took a long hot shower, and dressed carefully. Black pants, black sweater, nothing that would draw attention or underscore her big city ways. She drove slowly to town and parked on Front Street, wanting to approach the restaurant as a customer would. Notepad in hand, she headed across the street. The first thing she noticed was the bench out front. "Oh," she said softly, touching the wrought iron curled back. The metal felt cold against her fingertips, just as it had on the day they'd bought it. She closed her eyes, remembering. The four of them hadn't agreed on a thing all week. Not the song that should be sung at the funeral, nor who should sing it. Not what his headstone should look like, or what color roses should drape the casket. Until the bench. They'd been in the hardware store, looking for citronella candles for the celebration of Papa's life, when they'd seen this bench. Mama had stopped first. "Papa always wanted a bench outside the restaurant." "So folks could take a load off," Mira had said, coming up beside her. By the next morning, that bench had been secured to the sidewalk. They'd never discussed putting an In Memoriam plaque on it. That was the way of big cities. In West End, everyone knew that bench belonged to Tony DeSaria. The first week it was up, a dozen flowers appeared on it, single blossoms left by people who remembered. She stared up at the restaurant that had been his pride and joy. "I'll save it for you, Papa," she whispered, realizing a moment later that she was waiting for an answer. There was nothing, just the sound of traffic behind her and the distant hum of the sea. She uncapped her pen and held the tip poised just above the paper, at the ready. The brick facade was in need of repair. Moss grew beneath the eaves. A lot of shingles were missing. The red neon sign that read DeSaria's was missing the apostrophe and the I. She started writing. Roof. Exterior repair. Sidewalk dirty. Moss. Sign. She climbed the few steps to the front door and paused. A menu was posted behind glass on the wall. Spaghetti with meatballs was $7.95. A lasagna dinner, including bread and salad, was $6.95. No wonder they were losing money. Prices. Menu. She opened the door. A bell tinkled overhead. The pungent aromas of garlic, thyme, simmering tomatoes, and baking bread filled the air. She was drawn back in time. Not a thing had changed in 20 years. The dimly lit room, the round tables draped in red and white checked fabric, the pictures of Italy on the wall. She expected to see Papa come round the corner, grinning, wiping his hands on his apron, saying, "Bella Angelina, you're home!" "Well, well, you're really here. I was afraid you'd fallen down the cabin stairs and couldn't get up." Angie blinked, and wiped her eyes. Livy stood by the hostess table, wearing a pair of tight black jeans, a black off-the-shoulder blouse, and Barbie mules. Tension came off her sister in waves. It was as if they were kids again, teenagers fighting over who got to use the baby soft spray first. "I came to help," Angie said.
"Unfortunately, you can't cook, and you haven't worked at the restaurant since you got your braces off."
"No, wait! You never worked here." "I don't want us to fight, Livy." Livy sighed.
"I know. I don't mean to be a bitch. I'm just tired of all the crap. This place is bleeding money, and all Mama does is make more pans of lasagna. Mira bitches at me, but when I ask for help, she says she doesn't understand business, only cooking. And who does finally offer a hand? You, Daddy's princess. I don't know whether to laugh or cry."
She pulled a lighter out of her pocket and lit a cigarette. "You aren't going to smoke in here, are you?" Livy paused. "You sound like Papa." She dropped the cigarette into a half-full glass of water.
"I'm going to go work in the office. There's a lot of ordering and bill paying to do. You tell me when you figured out how to save the day."
Angie watched her sister leave, then headed into the kitchen where Mama was busy layering lasagna into big metal baking pans. Mira was right next to her, arranging meatballs on a metal tray that was only slightly smaller than a twin bed. At Angie's entrance, Mira looked up and smiled.
"Hey there!"
"Angie!"
Mama wiped her cheek, leaving a red tomato trail behind. Sweat beaded her brow.
"Are you ready to learn how to cook?"
She pushed the huge, smoky-colored eyeglasses higher on her nose.
"I'll hardly save the restaurant by cooking, Mama. I'm making notes."
Mama's smile fell a fraction. She shot a worried look at Mira, who merely shrugged.
"Notes?
On things I think might improve the business."
"And you're starting in my kitchen? Your papa, God rest his soul, loved—"
"Relax, Mama. I'm just checking things out."
"Mrs. Martin says you've read every restaurant reference book in the library," Mira said.
"Remind me not to rent any X-rated movies in this town," Angie said, smiling. Mama snorted.
"People watch out for each other here, Angela. That's a good thing."
"Don't get started, Mama. I was joking."
"I should hope so."
Mama pushed her heavy glasses higher on her nose and peered at Angie through owl-sized brown eyes.
"If you want to help, learn to cook."
"Papa couldn't cook." Mama blinked, sniffed, then went back to layering the ricotta parsley mixture over noodles. Mira and Angie exchanged a look. This was going to be worse than Angie thought. She was going to have to tread with extreme care. An irritated Livy was one thing. Mama pissed off was something else entirely. Barrow, Alaska, in the winter was warmer than Mama when she got mad. Angie looked down at her notes, feeling both pair of eyes on her. It took her a second to gather enough courage to ask, "So, how long has the menu been the same?" Mira grinned knowingly.
"Since the summer I went to Girl Scout camp."
"Very funny," Mama snapped. "We perfected it. Our regulars love every item."
"I'm not saying otherwise. I just wondered when you last changed the menu."
1975.
Angie underlined the word menu on her list. She might not know much about operating a restaurant, but she knew plenty about going out to dinner. A changing menu kept people coming back for more. "And do you offer nightly specials?"
"Everything is special. This isn't downtown Seattle, Angela. We do things our own way here. It was good enough for Papa, God rest his soul."
Mama's chin tilted in the air. The temperature in the kitchen dropped several degrees.
"Now, we'd better get back to work."
She elbowed Mira, who went back to hand-forming the meatballs. Angie knew when she'd been dismissed. She turned and went back into the empty dining room. She saw Livy over by the hostess desk. Her sister was talking to Rosa, the woman who'd started waitressing in the 70s. Angie waved and went upstairs. It was quiet in her father's office. She paused at the open doorway, letting the memories wash over her. In her mind, he was still there, sitting at the big oak desk he'd bought at a Rotary Club auction, poring over the accounts.
"Angelina, come in. I'll show you about taxes." "But I want to go to the movies, Papa." "Of course you do. Run along, then. Send Olivia up here."
She sighed heavily and went to his desk. She sat in his chair, heard the springs creak beneath her weight. For the next several hours, she studied and learned and made notes. She read all of the old account books and the tax records and her father's handwritten business notes. By the time she closed the last book, she knew that her mother was right. Desaria's was in trouble. Their income had dropped to almost nothing. She rubbed her eyes and closed the last book, then went downstairs. It was 7 o'clock, the middle of the dinner hour. There were two parties in the restaurant, Dr. and Mrs. Petrocelli and the Schmidt family. "Is it always this slow?" she said to Livy, who stood at the hostess table studying her talon fingernails. The bright red polish was dotted with pink stars. "Last Wednesday, we had 3 customers all night. You may want to write that down. They all ordered lasagna, in case you're interested. Like they had a choice. And it begins. I'm not here to criticize you, Liv. I'm just trying to help. You want to help? Figure out how to get people through the door, or how to pay Rosa Contadori's salary." She glanced over at the elderly waitress, who moved at a glacial pace, carrying one plate at a time. "It'll take some changes," Angie said, trying to be as gentle as possible. Livy tapped a long scarlet fingernail against her tooth. "Like what?" "Menu? Advertising? Decor? Pricing? Your payables are a mess. So is ordering. You guys are wasting a lot of food. You have to cook for people, even if they don't show up. I'm just saying that we're doing everything wrong." She raised her voice so that Mama could hear. "What's that?" Mama said, coming out of the kitchen. "Angie's been here half a day, Mama, long enough to know that we don't know shit." Mama looked down at them for a long moment, then turned and headed for the corner where she started talking to their curtain. Livy rolled her eyes. "Oh, good. She's getting Papa's opinion. If a dead man disagrees with me, I'm out of here," Livy said. Finally, Mama returned. She didn't look happy. "Papa tells me you think the menu is bad." Angie frowned. That was what she thought, but she hadn't told anyone yet. "Not bad, Mama, but change might be a good thing." Mama bit down on her lower lip, crossed her arms. "I know," she said to the air beside her. Then she looked at Livy. "Papa thinks we should listen to Angie, for now." "Of course he does. His princess." She glared at Angie. "I don't need this crap. I have a new husband who has begged me to stay home at night and make babies." The arrow hit its mark. Angie actually flinched. "So, that's what I'm going to do." She patted Angie's back. "Good luck with the place, little sis. It's all yours. You work nights and weekends." She turned on her high heel and walked out. Angie stared after her, wondering how it had gone bad so quickly. "All I said was we needed to make a few changes." "But not to the menu," Mama said, crossing her arms. "People love my lasagna." Lauren stared down at the question in front of her. A man walks 6 miles at 4 miles per hour. At what speed would he need to travel during the next 2.5 hours to have an average speed of 6 miles an hour during the entire trip? The answer choices blurred in front of her tired eyes. She pushed back from the table. She couldn't do this anymore. SAT preparation had filled so much of her time in the last month that she'd started to get headaches. It wouldn't do her any good if she aced the test but fell asleep in all of her classes. The test is in 2 weeks. With a sigh, she pulled back up to the table and picked up her pencil. She'd already taken this test last year and gotten a good score. This time she was hoping for a perfect 1600. For a girl like her, every point mattered. By the time the oven beeper went off, an hour later, she'd completed another 5 pages of the practice test. Numbers and vocabulary words and geometry equations floated through her head like those giant Star Wars spaceships bumping into one another. She went into the kitchen to make dinner before work. She could choose between a bowl of raisin bran and an apple with peanut butter. She picked the apple. There was no way to be sure how long the milk had been in there. When she finished eating, she dressed in a nice pair of black pants and a heavy pink sweater. Her Rite Aid smock covered most of the sweater, anyway. She grabbed her backpack, just in case she found time to finish her trigonometry homework on her dinner break, and left the apartment. She hurried down the stairs and was just reaching for the front doorknob when a tired voice said, "Lauren?" Dang it. She paused, turned. Mrs. Mock stood in the open doorway to her apartment. A tired frown pulled the edges of her mouth downward. "I'm still waiting for that rent check."
"I know."
She had trouble keeping her voice even. Mrs. Mock moved toward her. "I'm sorry, Lauren. You know I am, but I need to get paid. Otherwise, it's my job on the line." Lauren felt herself deflate. Now she'd have to ask her boss for an advance. She hated doing that.
"I know. I'll tell Mom."
"You do that." She headed for the door, heard Mrs. Mock say, "You're a good kid, Lauren." It was the same thing the manager said every time she had to ask for money. There was no answer to that, so Lauren kept walking, out into a rainy, navy blue night. It took 2 bus changes to get her out toward the highway where the neon-bright Rite Aid pharmacy offered all-night hours. She hurried into the store, even though she wasn't late. Even a few extra minutes on her time card helped.
Lauren?
It was Sally Ponacek, the pharmacist. As always, she was squinting.
"Mr. Landers wants to see you."
"Okay, thanks." She went back to the employees' lunchroom and dropped off her stuff, then went upstairs to the manager's small supply-cramped office. All the way there, she practiced how she would ask it.
"I've worked here for almost a year. I work every holiday, you know that. I'll work Thanksgiving and Christmas Eve this year. Is there any way I could get an advance on this week's salary?"
She forced herself to smile at him.
"You wanted to see me, Mr. Landers?"
He looked up from the papers on his desk. Lauren, yes." He ran a hand through his thinning hair, recombed what was left of it across his head. "There's no easy way to say this. We need to let you go. You've seen how slow business is. Word is, corporate is thinking of shutting this location down. The locals simply won't patronize a chain store. I'm sorry." It took a second.
"You're firing me?"
"Technically, we're laying you off. If business picks up." He let the inchoate promise dangle. They both knew business wouldn't pick up. He handed her a letter. "It's a glowing recommendation. I'm sorry to lose you, Lauren." The house was too quiet. Angie stood by the fireplace, staring out at the moonlit ocean. Heat radiated up her legs, but somehow didn't reach her core. She crossed her arms, cold still. It was only 8:30, too early for bed. She turned away from the window and looked longingly at the stairs. If only she could turn back time a few years. Become again the woman who slept easily. It had been easier with Conlon's arms around her. She hadn't slept alone in so long she'd forgotten how big a mattress could be, how much heat a lover's body generated. There was no way she'd sleep tonight, not the way she felt right now. What she needed was noise, the proximity of a life. She bent down and grabbed her keys off the coffee table, then headed for the door. 15 minutes later, she was parked in front of Mira's house. The small two-story house sat tucked on a tiny lot, hemmed on both sides by houses of remarkable similarity. The front yard was littered with toys and bikes and skateboards. Angie sat there a minute, clutching the steering wheel. She couldn't bust in on Mira's family at 9 o'clock. It would be too rude. But if she left now, where would she go? Back to the silence of her lonely cottage? To the shadowland of memories that were best left alone? She opened the door, got out. The night closed around her, chilled her. She smelled autumn. A bloated gray cloud floated overhead, started spitting rain on the sidewalk. She hurried up the walk and knocked on the front door. Mira answered almost instantly. She stood in the entry, smiling sadly, wearing an old football jersey and Grinch slippers. Her long hair was unbound. It cascaded down her sides in an unruly mass. "I wondered how long you were going to sit out there." "You knew? Are you kidding? Kim Fisk called the minute you parked. Andrea Schmidt called 5 seconds later. You forget what it's like to live in a neighborhood." Angie felt like an idiot. "Oh, come on in. I figured you'd be by." She led the way down a linoleum-covered hallway and turned into the family room, where a huge brown sectional framed a big-screen television. Two glasses of red wine waited on the oak coffee table. Angie couldn't help smiling. She sat down on the sofa and reached for the wine glass. "Where is everyone?" "The little ones are asleep, the big ones are doing homework, and tonight is Vince's league night." Mira stretched out on the sofa, looking at Angie. "Well?"
"Well, what? You were just driving around in the dark?"
"Something like that."
"Come on, Ange. Livy quit. Mama threw down the lasagna gauntlet, and the restaurant is bleeding."
Angie looked up, trying to smile. "And don't forget that I'm learning to live alone."
"By the looks of it, that isn't going well."
"No." She took a sip of wine. Maybe more than a sip. She didn't really want to talk about her life. All it did was wound her. "I need to convince Livy to come back." Mira sighed, obviously disappointed by Angie's change in subject.
"We probably should have told you that she's wanted to quit for months."
"Yeah, that would have been good to know."
"Look on the bright side. There's one less of us to piss off when you start making changes."
For some reason, the word changes hit Angie hard. She put down the wine glass and stood up, then moved to the window, staring out as if her location had been the problem. "Angie? I don't know what the hell is wrong with me lately." Mira came up beside her, touched her shoulder.
"You need to slow down."
"What do you mean?"
"Ever since you were a girl, you've been running for what you wanted. You couldn't get out of West End quickly enough. Poor Tommy Matucci asked about you for 2 years after you left, but you never called him. Then you rushed through college and blistered up the food chain in advertising."
Her voice softened. "And when you and Conlon decided to start your family, you immediately started tracking your ovulation and working at it. A lot of good it did me. The point is, now you're lost, but you're still running full speed. Away from Seattle and your ruined marriage, toward West End and the failing restaurant. How will you ever figure out what you want when everything is a blur?"
Angie stared at her reflection in the window. Her skin looked parchment pale, her eyes seemed bruised by darkness, and her mouth was barely a strip.
"What do you know about wanting?" she said, hearing the ache in her voice.
"I have 4 kids. A husband who loves his bowling league almost as much as he loves me, and I've never had a boss who wasn't related to me. While you were sending me postcards from New York and London and Los Angeles, I was trying to save enough money to get my hair cut. Believe me, I know about wanting."
Angie wanted to turn and face her sister, but she didn't dare. "I would have traded it all, the trips, the lifestyle, the career, for just one of those babies upstairs."
Mira touched her shoulder. "I know." Angie finally turned and knew instantly it was a mistake. Mira's eyes were full of tears.
"I need to go. Angie said, hearing the thickness of her voice. Don't! She pushed past Mira and ran for the front door. Outside, rain slashed at her, blurred her vision. Not caring, she raced for the car, hearing Mira's "Come back!" echoing behind her.
I can't, she said, too softly for her sister to hear.
She climbed into the car and slammed the door, starting the engine and backing out before Mira could follow her. She drove up one street and down another, barely aware of where she was. The radio was turned on high volume. Right now, Cher was singing at her, "To Believe in Love." At last she found herself in the Safeway parking lot, drawn like a moth to the bright lights. There, she sat beneath the glaring street lamp, staring out at the rain hammering her windshield.
I would have traded it all.
She squeezed her eyes shut. Just saying those words aloud had hurt. No! She wouldn't sit here and stew about it. Enough was enough! This was definitely the last time she'd vow to forget what couldn't be changed. She'd go into the store, buy some over-the-counter sleeping pills, and take just enough to get her through the night. She got out of her car and went into the sprawling, white-lit store. None of her family would be here, she knew. They patronized the locals. She went straight to the aspirin aisle and found what she was looking for. She was halfway to the checkout aisle when she saw them. A bird-thin woman in dirty clothes carrying 3 cartons of cigarettes and a 12-pack of beer. 4 raggedly dressed children buzzed around her. One of them, the smallest, asked for a donut and the mother cuffed him. The children's hair and faces were filthy. Their tennis shoes were pocked with holes. Angie stopped. Her breathing felt heavy. She closed her eyes and swallowed hard as they moved past her. The pain welled up again. If it would have done any good, she would have looked up at God and begged to know why. Why did some women make babies so easily while others... She dropped the box of sleeping pills and walked out of the store. Outside, rain hit her hard, mingled with her tears. In the car, she sat perfectly still, staring through the beaded windshield. In time, the family came out of the store. They piled into a shabby car and drove off. None of the kids put on a seatbelt. Angie closed her eyes. She knew that if she sat here long enough, it would pass. Grief was like a rain cloud. Sooner or later, if you were patient, it moved on. All she had to do was keep breathing. Something smacked on her windshield. Her eyes opened. A pink flyer was on her windshield. It read, "Work wanted. Steady. Reliable." Before she could read any more, the rain pummeled the flyer, ruined the ink. Angie leaned toward the passenger seat and rolled down the window. A girl with red hair was planting the flyers. She moved stoically from car to car, heedless of the rain, wearing a threadbare coat and faded jeans. Angie didn't think. She reacted. Getting out of the car, she yelled, "Hey, you!" The girl looked up. Angie ran toward her. "Can I help you?" "No." The girl started to move away. Angie reached into her coat pocket and pulled out money. "Here," she said, pressing the wad of bills into the girl's cold, wet hand. "I can't take that," the girl whispered, shaking her head. "Please, for me," Angie said. They looked at each other for a long moment. Finally, the girl nodded. Tears filled her eyes. "Thanks." Then she turned and ran into the night. Lauren climbed the dark, shadowy stairs toward the apartment building. Every step seemed to draw something out of her, until by the time she reached Mrs. Mock's front door, Lauren was certain she'd grown smaller somehow. She was so tired of feeling vulnerable and alone. She paused, staring down at the damp wad of bills in her hand. $125. "For me," the woman in the parking lot had said, as if she were the one in need. Yeah, right. Lauren knew Charity when she saw it. She'd wanted to turn it down, maybe laugh lightly and say, "You've got me all wrong." Instead, she'd run all the way home. She wiped the leftover tears from her eyes and knocked on the door. Mrs. Mauck answered. When she saw Lauren, her smile faded.
"You're soaking wet."
"I'm fine," Lauren said. "Here." Mrs. Mauck took the money, counted it. There was a small pause. Then the woman said,
"I'll just take 100 of it, okay? You go buy yourself something decent to eat."
Lauren almost started to cry again. Before the tears could fill her eyes, she turned away and ran for the stairway. In her apartment, she called out for her mother. Silence answered her. With a sigh, she tossed her backpack onto the sofa and went to the refrigerator. It was practically empty. She was just reaching for a half-eaten sandwich when someone knocked. She crossed the small, messy apartment and opened the door. David stood there, holding a big cardboard box.
"Hey, Trix," he said.
"What?"
"I called the pharmacy. They said you didn't work there anymore."
"Oh."
She bit her lip. The softness of his voice and the understanding in his eyes was almost more than she could take right now.
"So, I cleaned out the fridge at home. Mom had a dinner party last night, and there were killer leftovers."
He reached into the box and pulled out a videotape.
"And I brought my speed racer tapes."
She found the tiniest start of a smile.
"Did you bring the one where Trixie saves his ass?"
He gazed down at her. In that single look, she saw everything. Love, understanding, caring.
"Of course."
"Thank you," was all she could say.
"You should have called me, you know, when you lost your job."
He didn't know how it felt to lose something you needed so desperately. But he was right. She should have called him. Even at 17, as young and immature as he could sometimes be, he was the steadiest person in her life. When she was with him, her future, their future, seemed as pure and shimmering as a pearl.
"I know."
"Now come on, let's get something to eat and watch a movie. I have to be home by midnight."
Chapter 5. Mr. Lundberg droned on and on, flittering from one contemporary social issue to another like a child chasing soap bubbles. Lauren tried to pay attention. She really did, but she was more than exhausted.
"Lauren? Lauren?"
She blinked awake, realizing a second too late that she'd fallen asleep. Mr. Lundberg was staring at her. He did not look happy. She felt her cheeks grow hot. That was the problem with being a redhead. Pale skin blushed easily.
"Yes, Mr. Lundberg?"
"I asked for your position on capital punishment."
"Prone!" someone called out. Everyone laughed. Lauren tried to suppress a giggle.
"I'm against the death penalty, at least until we can ensure that it's being fairly and uniformly carried out. No, wait, I'm against it anyway. The state should not be in the business of killing people to preserve the notion that killing is morally wrong."
Mr. Lundberg nodded, then turned back to the television he'd set up in the middle of the room.
"In the past weeks, we've discussed justice, or its lack, in America. I think sometimes we forget how fortunate we are to be able to have such discussions. Things are very different in other parts of the world. In Sierra Leone, for example."
He pushed a tape into the VCR and hit play. Halfway through the documentary, the bell rang. Lauren gathered her books and notebooks and left the classroom. In the halls, the noise was amped up, the laughing "Hey Dude" soundtrack of Day's End. She moved through the crowd, too tired to do much more than wave at passing friends. David came up behind her, pulled her into his arms. She twisted around and clung to him, staring up into his blue, blue eyes. The noise in the hallway faded to a buzzing whine. The memories of last night came to her all at once, made her smile.
He had saved her. It was as simple as that.
"My parents had to dash off to New York tonight," he whispered. "They won't be home till Saturday."
"Really?
Football is out at 5:30. You want me to pick you up?"
"No. I need to look for a new job after school."
"Oh, right."
She heard the disappointment in his voice. She pressed onto her toes and kissed him, tasting the fruity residue of his daily Snapple.
"I could be to your house by 7.
He grinned. "Great! Do you need a ride?"
"No, I'll be fine. Should I bring anything?"
He grinned. "Mom left me $200. We'll order pizza."
$200. That was the amount of back rent they still owed, and David could spend it on pizza.
Lauren was ready to go job hunting. She'd gone to the school library and printed off 15 copies of her resume. She had an equal number of recommendation letters. Hopefully, it would be enough. She was just about ready to leave when her mother tore into the house. The front door cracked against the wall. Mom ran to the sofa and threw the cushions aside, looking for something. There was nothing there. Wild-eyed, she looked up.
"Did you say I looked fat?"
"You don't weigh 100 pounds, Mom."
"I didn't say you were fat. If anything, you're too thin. There's food."
Mom held up a hand. A cigarette wobbled between her fingers, spewed ash.
"Don't start with me. I know you think I drink too much and don't eat enough, like I need a kid policing me."
She glanced around the room again, frowning, then raced off to the kitchen. In 2 minutes, she was back.
"I need money."
Some nights, Lauren remembered that her mother was sick, that alcoholism was a disease. On those nights, she felt sorry for her. This wasn't one of those times.
"We're broke, Mom. It would help if you went to work."
She tossed her backpack on the kitchen table and bent to pick up the fallen cushions.
"You work! All I need is a few bucks."
"Please, baby." Mom sidled close, placing a hand on Lauren's back. The touch reminded Lauren that they were a team, she and Mom. Dysfunctional, certainly, but a family nonetheless. Mom's hand slid up Lauren's arm and closed around her shoulder. The hold was pure desperation.
"Come on," she said, her voice trembling.
$10 will do it."
Lauren reached into her pocket and pulled out a wadded-up 5. Thank God she'd hidden the 20 under her pillow.
"I won't have lunch money tomorrow."
Mom grabbed the bill.
"Pack yourself something. There's PB&J and crackers in the fridge."
Cracker sandwiches. Perfect. Thank God for the leftovers David had brought over, she thought. Mom was already moving to the door. When she opened it, she stopped and turned around. Her green eyes looked sad. The lines on her face made her appear a decade older than 34. She ran a hand through her spiked, unkempt white hair.
"Where'd you get that suit?"
"Mrs. Mock. It's her daughter's."
"Susie Mock died 6 years ago."
Lauren shrugged, unable to think of a response.
"She kept her daughter's clothes all those years? Wow."
Some mothers would find it painful to throw their child's clothes away.
"Whatever. Why are you dressed in a dead girl's suit?"
"I need a job."
"You work at the drugstore."
"I got laid off. Times are bad."
"I've been trying to tell you that. I'm sure they'll hire you back for the holidays."
"We need money now. The rent is late." Her mom seemed to still, and in the sadness of her look, Lauren saw a glimpse of the beauty her mother had once had.
"Yeah, I know."
They stared at each other. Lauren found herself leaning forward, waiting.
"Say you'll go to work tomorrow," she thought.
"I gotta go," Mom said at last.
Without a backward glance, she left the apartment. Lauren tucked away the ridiculous disappointment she felt and followed her mother out.
By the time she reached the picturesque heart of West End, the rain had stopped. It was only 5 o'clock, but this time of year, night had started to come earlier. The sky was a pale purple. Her first stop was the seaside, a booming tourist stop that featured microbrews and local oysters. 1 hour and 20 minutes later, she had made her way from one end of Main Street to the other. 3 restaurants had politely taken her resume and promised to call her if a job came up. Another 2 had not bothered with false hopes. All 4 of the retail shops had told her to come back after Thanksgiving. Now she stood in front of the last restaurant on the block. Desaria's. She glanced at her watch. It was 6:12. She was going to be late to David's house. With a sigh, she climbed the few steps to the front door, noticing that they were rickety. Not a good sign. By the front door, she paused to look at the menu. The highest-priced item was manicotti at $8.95. That was not a good sign either. Still, she opened the door and went inside. It was a small place. The walls were brick. An archway separated the space into 2 equally sized rooms, each of which held 5 or 6 tables that were draped in red and white fabric. An oak-mantled fireplace dominated one room. Pictures hung in wooden frames on the rough burgundy-colored walls. Family pictures, by the look of them. There were also framed prints of Italy and grapes and olives. Music was playing. An instrumental version of I Left My Heart in San Francisco. The aroma was pure heaven. There was one family having dinner. One. Not much of a crowd for a Friday night. There was no point in applying here for a job. She might as well give up for tonight. Maybe, if she hurried, she could get home, change her clothes, and make it to David's by 7 o'clock. She turned and headed back outside. As she walked to the bus stop, it started to rain again. A cold wind swept off the ocean and roared through town. Her tattered coat was no shield at all, and by the time she got home, she was freezing. The front door stood open, but even worse, the dining room window was open too. "Shit," Lauren muttered, rubbing her cold hands together as she kicked the door shut. She hurried to the window. As she reached for it, she heard her mother's voice singing, "Leavin' on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be back again." Lauren paused. Anger rippled through her, made her bunch her fists. If she'd been a boy, she might have punched the wall. She hadn't found a job, she was late for her date, and now this. Her mother was drunk and communing with the stars again. Lauren climbed through the window and up the rickety fire escape that hugged this side of the building. On the rooftop, she found her mother sitting on the ledge of the building, wearing a soaking wet cotton dress. Her feet were bare. Lauren came up behind her, taking care not to get too close to the edge. "Mom?" Mom twisted slightly and smiled at her.
"Hey."
"You're too close to the edge, Mom. Move back."
"Sometimes you gotta remember you're alive. Come here."
She patted the ledge beside her. Lauren hated times like this. Moments where her need ran alongside fear. Her mother loved to live dangerously. She always said so. Lauren moved cautiously forward. Very slowly, she sat beside her mother. The street below them was almost empty. A single car drove past, its headlights blinking through the rain, looking insubstantial, unreal. Lauren could feel her mother trembling with the cold. "Where's your coat, Mom?"
"I lost it." "No, I gave it to Phoebe. Traded it for a carton of smokes. The rain makes everything look beautiful, doesn't it?"
"You traded your coat for cigarettes," she said dully, knowing it was useless to be angry. "They're predicting a cold winter this year." Mom shrugged.
"I was broke."
Lauren put her arm around her mother.
Come on. You need to get warmed up. A bath would be good.
Mom looked at her. Franco said he'd call today.
Did you hear the phone ring?
No. Tears filled her eyes slowly. They never come back. Not to me. Even though Lauren had heard it 1,000 times, she still felt her mother's pain.
I know. Come on.
She helped her to her feet and guided her to the fire escape. Lauren followed her mother down the iron grate stairs and into the apartment. Once there, she convinced her mother to take a hot bath, then went into her own room and changed her clothes. By the time she was ready to leave, her mother was in bed. Lauren went to her, sat on the edge of the bed beside her.
You'll be okay while I'm gone?
Mom's eyes were already getting heavy.
Did the phone ring while I was in the bath?
No. Slowly, Mom looked at her.
How come no one loves me, Lauren?
The question, asked softly and with such utter despair, hurt Lauren so deeply that she gasped. Mom turned her head into the pillow and closed her eyes. Slowly, Lauren got to her feet and backed away from the bed. All she could think about as she made her way through the apartment and down the stairs and across town was David. David. He would fill this emptiness in her heart. The staid, ultra-rich enclave called Mountain Air inhabited only a few city blocks on the easternmost edge of West End. But there, behind the guarded gates and ironwork fences, another world existed. This oasis of wealth dominated a hillside overlooking the ocean. Here in David's world, the driveways were made of stone or patterned brick. The cars pulled up beneath fancy porticos and parked in cavernous garages. Dinners were eaten off china as thin and translucent as a baby's skin. On an evening like this one, street lamps lit every corner and turned the falling rain into tiny diamonds. Lauren felt acutely out of place as she walked up to the guardhouse at the entrance gate. A girl who didn't belong. She imagined that a notation was made on some chart that would be presented to Mr. and Mrs. Haynes on their return. Bad element visits home. "I'm here to see David Haynes," she said, forcing her hands to her side. He smiled knowingly. The gate buzzed, then swung open. She followed the winding black asphalt road past dozens of homes that looked like magazine covers. Georgian mansions, French villas, Bel Air-style haciendas. It was so quiet here. No honking horns, no fighting neighbors or blaring television noise. As always, Lauren tried to imagine how it felt to belong in a place like this. No one in Mountain Air worried about back rent or how to pay the light bill. She knew that if a person had started here, there was no destination that was out of reach. She walked up the path to the front door. Fragrant, saucer-sized pink roses hemmed her in on either side, made her feel a little bit like a princess in a fairy tale. Dozens of hidden lights illuminated the landscaped yard, made it look like a movie set. She knocked on the big mahogany front door. It was only a moment before David answered. So quickly, in fact, she thought perhaps he'd been waiting at the window. "You're late," he said, smiling slowly. He pulled her into his arms, right there in the open doorway where all the neighbors could see. She wanted to tell him to wait, to close the door. But once he kissed her, she forgot everything else. He'd always had that effect on her. At night, when she was in bed alone and thinking about him, missing him, she wondered about her odd amnesia. Her only explanation for it was love. What else could make a perfectly sane girl think that without her boyfriend's touch, the sun might slip out of the sky and leave the world cold and dark? She looped her arms around his neck and smiled up at him. Their night hadn't even really begun, and already her chest felt tight with anticipation. "What did you tell your mom? Does she think you're spending the night at Kim's house?"
Yeah, Kim's.
She tried to imagine a life like that, one where someone, a mom, was waiting for you, worrying about you. No lies were needed in the Ribido apartment. Mom had spoken to Lauren about